So, it's really good to be here. It's a real, Roger, thank you for the invitation to be here. I feel like in many ways I know you, even though I've never been here before. So I want to tell you what I mean by that. I started my ministry at First Universalist Church in Minneapolis in 2009, the fall of 2009. And for the next 3 years, Roger was my mentor. We talked almost every month for about an hour or so. And, of course, it's my first ministry, and I had lots of questions about all kinds of things, how to navigate challenging situations, how to start new initiatives, all of this. And Roger was a fabulous mentor. His gentle questions, his gentle, challenging questions and observations and reflections and sharing the journey that this fellowship has gone through to three services and this building expansion project here, and now all of that really helped and held and shaped me as a minister. So I want you to know the impact, not only here in this fellowship, but around the country, really, that Roger has. And I thank you for that mentoring and that time together. You have an amazing senior minister and minister team here, and I trust that you recognize that. So I grew up Unitarian Universalist. And I loved it. I loved it. In many ways, I was a church nerd, if you will. Really, I was involved in my youth group. I was involved in Sunday morning services. I was involved in social justice projects and so much more. The church was central in my life then, and it's central in my life now. I love this faith. I would even say this faith saves me. I don't mean that it saves me from hell. I mean that it saves me in the sense that it calls me back to a kind of wholeness. It helps me find the best in myself and calls that forward. It helps me find my way home to my deepest, most authentic self. This faith is an anchor, if you will. It's a lifeline for me. Let me tell you more about what I mean when I say anchor, when I say lifeline. And to do that, I want to share a story with you. This is a story that comes from Parker Palmer, an author, an educator, a teacher, a Quaker, and he shares this story. There used to be a time, he says, when the farmers of the Great Plains, at the first sign of a blizzard, maybe something like we'll see today, I don't know, at the first sign of a blizzard, they would run a rope from the back door of their house out to the barn door, because these farmers knew people who had gotten lost in that short distance from the back door of the house to the barn in a big blizzard, had gotten lost, had wandered away, and had died. And so at the first sign of a blizzard, they would put this rope from the back door out to the barn door. And some of you, I see you nodding. You know this experience. Either you know it personally, or your parents or grandparents were farmers or those who practiced this thing. But for many of us, including myself, this is a little bit abstract. It's a little bit removed from my real-life experience. When a blizzard comes, I don't tie a rope from my back door to my garage door or any other place. I'm usually fine. I live in a city. It's a very different experience. So in this story, Parker Palmer goes on to say, here's the reality. In our world today, we're dealing with another sort of blizzard. It's a blizzard without snow, but it's just as blinding. It's a blizzard of physical and spiritual violence, a blizzard of racism and deceit and fear and greed, a blizzard of indifference to the suffering of others. It's a blizzard of hopelessness, of addiction, of depression, where people are lost in the darkness that is their own lives. On the surface, he says, things seem fine, but underneath, there is a whiteout. On the surface, things seem fine, but just underneath the surface in many of our lives, there is a whiteout. And don't we know those people, or aren't we those people who are lost or have been lost in that modern day blizzard, trying our best to find our way home back to wholeness? And I wonder, when I think about this story in my own faith community, in this faith community, I wonder how many of you, when you first came into this place, when you first sat in these pews, whether you've been here a couple of weeks or a couple of months or years, when you first came into this place, you had that feeling of coming home. You sat down and were surprised because there were tears in your eyes, or you felt such relief that you could be who you were when you settled into this place. I wonder how many of you, when you came here, had that feeling of coming home. I'm curious. If you just want to share with me, put your hand up. Many of you, I had the same experience in my faith community, the sense of I can be who I am here. I have come home. I imagine you felt like this place could be a lifeline, could call you back to a kind of wholeness. This place could help you survive the blizzard in your life, whatever it was, could help you survive and find your way home. So like I said, I grew up Unitarian Universalist, and I love this faith because I believe that our faith communities, communities like this, have the potential to change our lives and to change the world, to be lifelines, if you will. It's why I became a minister. I sensed the promise of this kind of faith community, a faith community that said, in essence, we are all held by love, a love that will not let us go. And I'm guessing that's why you're here this morning. You also sense the promise of this place. But here's the rub, friends. Here's the thing. The promises, on one hand, and the actual practices of our faith, the promises and the actual practices, what we do, those things, to me, often seem to be at odds with one another. Here's what I mean by that. If we are truly a powerful, life-changing faith, which I believe we are, why, at least in my congregation, I suspect it's true here, why do we so often neglect to tell our friends and acquaintances that we're at a Unitarian Universalist fellowship and that it's changing our lives? Why are we silent about something that matters so deeply to us and our families? And I wonder, in that same spirit of the promises and the practices, I wonder, this is how it is in my congregation, I suspect it's true here as well, why do we give less than we could financially to a place that is central in our lives, a place that instills in our children these values we care so deeply about? So I hold those questions and questions like those, and it feels like the promises of our faith and the practices of our faith, what we actually do, sometimes those things are so far apart. That troubles me. It disturbs me on some level. But the good news is, in this problem, is it's not unique to us. It's not a new problem. In fact, communities of faith throughout history have wrestled with this essential tension between what the faith calls you to be and do in the world and then what you actually do. Love your neighbors and love God with all your heart. And then the actual challenge of loving, like, that particular neighbor next to you that is driving you nuts because their dog is barking all the time or whatever it might be. It's not a new challenge for people of faith. We have wrestled, many have wrestled with that question for a long time. So I think maybe it would be helpful this morning to hear a couple of stories of people and communities who live in that tension between promises and practices and see how they have resolved that tension or how they live in that tension between the promises and the actual practices. The first story I want to share with you this morning is from the book Tattoos on the Heart by Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest. This story is about a time when Greg Boyle was serving in a parish, and he writes, in 1987, the church made the decision to house homeless men in its space. Once the homeless men began to sleep in the church at night, there was always the faintest evidence they'd been there. Come Sunday morning, we'd foo-foo the place as best we could. We would sprinkle "I love my carpet" on the rugs, but the smell remained, he says. And then the grumbling set in, and people started talking about churching somewhere else or going somewhere else because it just smelled a little bit. The smell was never overwhelming, he said, just undeniably there. So we determined to address the discontent one Sunday, and I asked the congregation that morning, "What does the church smell like?" People were mortified. Eye contact ceased, and women searched inside their purses for they knew not what. You know? "Come on now," he says. He says to his congregation, "What's the church smell like?" "Huele a patas." It smells like feet. Don Rafael booms out. He was old and really didn't care what people thought. "Excellent, excellent," says Greg Boyle. "But why? Why does it smell like feet?" "Because many homeless men slept here last night," says a woman. "Well, why do we let that happen here?" says Greg Boyle. "Es nuestro compromiso." "It's what we've committed to do," says another. "Well, why would anyone commit to do that?" "Porque es lo que haría Jesús." "Because it's what Jesus would do." "Well then," says Greg Boyle, "what does the church smell like now?" And a man stands and bellows, "Huele a nuestro compromiso." "It smells like our commitment." It smells like commitment. And the place cheers. The place erupts. It smells like commitment. Now, I'm not saying that this is the path this fellowship should take, but I do want to suggest that that feeling you're having right now, the feeling I had when I first read this story and now shared it with you again, that feeling, that is the spirit of life stirring in you, awakening in you, inviting you to remember your deepest commitments, your deepest promises, even when it's a stretch, even when it's challenging to fulfill that commitment. One more story about promises and practices, this one from the Gospel of Mark. In this story, Jesus is in the village of Capernaum. It's a little village on the north side of the Sea of Galilee. He's in a house. He has been teaching and preaching and talking and healing all day, and there's a big crowd gathered around. The house is packed. The doorways are packed. There are people outside of the house trying to see what's going inside. And I imagine this scene, if you imagine this with me, it might be something comparable to this. The Dalai Lama has been invited to speak in Appleton. It's been well publicized. Everybody knows about it, and they've put him in a conference room that holds 50 people. Right? So the room is full, and there are people outside the room trying to look in and see what's going on. It's that kind of scene that we're talking about here. So in this story, people are trying to get inside and find out what's going on, and there are some folks outside of the house who climb up on the roof of the house, on the flat roof of the house, and they begin to pull off the tiles on the roof, and they pull off enough tiles that they can lower down into the house this paralyzed man so Jesus can heal him. Greg Boyle, who I told you about earlier, he remarks about this story, and he says the focus of this story is understandably, and there's amazing pictures of this, artwork of this throughout time, is understandably the healing of this paralytic, of this paralyzed man. The focus of the story is the roof coming off, and then this really the focus is on this man coming into this house. But he says there's something more significant than that that is going on here. They are ripping the roof off the place, and those on the outside are coming in. Those on the outside are being welcomed and let in to the inside. The barriers that exclude are being removed and taken away, dismantled. Everyone, metaphorically, everyone is welcome into that place of love and healing. So in this story, the roof, tile by tile, is undone, so that everything can be redone in a more life-giving, new, reimagined way. In this story, those on the outside are welcomed into the inside. These stories, the two I've just shared, they inspire me. And they point to the heart of what I believe as a Unitarian Universalist. And that is this. We are all love's people, held by a love that will not let us go. We are called to be love's people in the world, to make that love real in the world by removing the barriers that exclude and oppress. So stories like these help me see what can happen when we align the promises and the practices of our faith. And friends, if you don't know this, and I know that many of you do, you are in the middle of such a story about alignment, promises, and practices right now. You are in the middle of that story here at the Fellowship. You are on the edge of something incredible, but you're not there yet. I have watched from afar. I have talked with Roger. I know you have run a successful capital campaign, that you have plans to expand the worship space out this window. You have plans to expand the footprint of this place, adding classrooms and office space, provided that your annual giving increases because you will have a mortgage payment that goes with this expansion. I know that for decades you have been a leader in this community around gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender justice and inclusion. And you're just getting started in so many ways. You have so much more you can and will do. You are at a pivotal moment in your history, a moment filled with so much promise. You are, metaphorically and figuratively, and really literally, preparing to tear the roof, not off of this place right here, but in essence, off of this building as you grow and expand. You will become undone to one way of being so that you might be redone in a different, more inclusive, more welcoming way as you make space for all those who yearn for a place like this to grow in mind and spirit and lead in social justice. You are at a critical moment as you seek to strengthen this church as a lifeline, as a pathway back to home and wholeness. And so, in this moment today, at this critical juncture, I want to invite you to stretch in your spiritual practice of giving. To stretch so that the promises and commitments of this place can truly come alive. Let's not fool ourselves. Let's not fool ourselves at all. It takes resources and money to make your dreams, our dreams, come alive. And I can promise you this. As you stretch in your giving, you will also come alive. As you stretch and give a meaningful gift, you will come alive. The poet and author Khalil Gibran says it this way. He says, "To live is to give." To give is to live. To give is to live. To withhold is to perish. To give is to live. To withhold is to perish. Giving, then, can be a spiritual life-giving practice. Giving as a spiritual practice upends the consumer culture narrative around money. You know this story, right? I'll tell it to you, because I think you know it. As soon as I tell it to you, you'll know you know it. Here's how the consumer culture story around money works and why giving as a spiritual practice completely upends this story. That story, the consumer culture story around money works like this. You give Comcast money, and they give you cable TV or internet, right? You give Gold's Gym or Lifetime Fitness or whoever some money, and then you expect to be able to go in there and work out on those machines. Right? That's how that works. You give Apple some money, and they give you an iPhone. That's the essential equation. That's the consumer culture story about money. You give something, and you get something back in return. But giving as a spiritual practice doesn't fit into that equation the same way. Instead, giving as a spiritual practice is an invitation to recognize what you have, to take inventory of your life, what you have, what you've been blessed with, how so much of what you have was given by others, the education, the teachers, the parents, the friends, the mentors, all of those people who helped make your life what it is, to see those gifts and blessings in your life, and then to say, really, the only response to the gift of my life of being here is to give back. That's, in my view, the only response that you can have. It's a way to recognize that none of us and really got here by ourselves, and none of what we have is really ours. We don't get to take any of it with us. I know sometimes I live that way, like, I'm going to take this all with me, like, after I die. Not so much. We're just stewards. We're just caretakers of it while we're here. To give is to live. To withhold is to perish. Giving our time, our attention, our money, our love. Check this against the screen of your own life. Giving those things, giving your time and attention and money and love, that is a way to really come alive. When you are really giving those things to someone else, there's something in you that awakens. And this is why my family and I have increased our giving at the church I serve until we now give 5% of our income to the church in addition to our other giving. Giving 5% of our income is incredibly meaningful to us, because we're giving to something that matters in our life. And I suspect for many of you, as it is in my congregation, giving 5% of your income might feel impossible. And I will tell you honestly, for my wife and I, at first it really did. You know, we didn't have models in our life. Our parents didn't model this for us. We didn't grow up in a faith community that really talked openly about money and giving. We weren't taught that by anyone, but we knew it was something that we wanted to do, and so we took it in steps. We knew where we wanted to get to, and we did it step by step, knowing that ultimately we wanted to give the church one nickel for every dollar that we earned. That's what we wanted to do. That's what 5% is. It's a nickel on every dollar you earn. And it feels good. It feels good to do that. We're adults. We are all adults. And institutions have taken care of us for so much of our lives. And it feels great to take care of the institutions that we love. So today, this morning, I'm asking you to have the money and the giving conversation with yourself or your partner, your family, and to stretch this year. That might mean redirecting some of your capital campaign giving and rolling that into your pledge. It definitely means stretching, giving until it really means something to you. If you're not already pledging 5% of your income, and I understand from Roger that many of you are, and I know Roger is as well, take a step toward pledging 5%. That's a nickel on every dollar you earn. If that seems impossible, if you're pledging 1 or 2% of your income, stretch to 2 or 3% of your income. The church, as I see it, is probably worth 3 cents on every dollar you earn. And if you don't like percentages, and I know if you're like my congregations, you're like, I don't think in percentages, that doesn't work for me. Maybe you could think about increasing your pledge by $100 a month or $75 a month. The point is, discover what a meaningful stretch is for you and then commit to it, because your shared generosity will allow you to build the future that you dream of, to touch the lives in this community. After all, does Comcast, does Gold's Gym or Apple care about your spiritual development and life journey? Do they care about how you live a life of meaning and purpose? Do those things marry and bury and dedicate your children? Do they walk with you through life's ups and downs? Not so far as I know. Not so far as I know. Those things don't care a whit about your wholeness or your life. This place, this faith does. I think back to that story from Greg Boyle when he asks his church. He says, what does this place smell like? He says, what does this place smell like? And so I want to ask you this morning, what does the building project that you are on the edge of, what does that building project that you're on the edge of smell like? It smells like commitment. What does a significant increase in your giving smell like? It smells like commitment. It smells like living into the promise of this faith. So, friends, I invite you this morning to make this fellowship the strongest lifeline that it can be. Be bold in your practice of giving. Go for 5 cents on every dollar you earn. Be bold in your practice of giving so that together, you might know this truth. From you I receive, to you I give. Together we share, and from this we live. May it be so. And amen.